Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Last month, we did a show about the rapid decline of the bee population. Nearly one-third of bee colonies perished last winter, causing significant agricultural losses. In addition to the use of pesticides, the reduction of plant diversity has been cited as one of the many reasons for the decline. Scientists have found out that bees eating pollen from a range of plants showed signs of having a much healthier immune system than those eating pollen from a single type. A third of our food supply, fibers, and medicines depend on pollinators like bees, butterflies, hummingbirds, and other wildlife. So on today's Your Call, we are talking about what we can do to bring the birds and the bees back to our gardens and community farms. How can we bring back the diversity these pollinators thrive on? Today, we're joined by Ellen Zagary, Director of Horticulture at the UC Davis Arboretum. She serves as a spokesperson for the Arboretum in their education and outreach programs, promoting sustainable garden plants and practices. Ellen focuses on how our constructed landscapes can help support the biodiversity of native insects and other wildlife. And she joins us from Davis. Hi, Ellen. Welcome to the show.
Hello.
Hi, nice to have you.
Oh,
we're also joined today by Daniel Miller, Director of Spiral Gardens Community Food Security Project in Berkeley. Their mission is to create healthy and sustainable communities by promoting a strong local food system and encouraging productive use of urban soil. And Daniel joins us in studio. Hi, Daniel. Welcome to the show.
Hello, Rose, Ellen, and everybody out there. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's great to have you. So, Ellen, let's start off with you. We did a show about the rapid decline of the bee population last month and got an overwhelming response. And it's been getting a lot of media attention. Can you give us an update? Is it still as bad as it was in the past few months?
Well, one of the main problems is that agriculture depends on the European honeybee. It's not a native bee. And so since they are worked so hard, those honeybees are raised in hives, and they're moved from farm to farm, and they just are worked super hard, and then they don't get the kind of, as you mentioned, diverse pollen sources. So they it's kind of like if we only ate white bread all the time, we'd get worn out. You know, we wouldn't get the vitamins and be as strong as we might be. So that's part of the problem. The second thing is that native bees can also help with pollination, but we've, in urban and in intensely managed agriculture areas, we have eliminated a lot of the native vegetation that supports the native bees as well as the honeybee. And so that's kind of the crux of the problem, is trying to bring back more of those naturalized, we call them, landscapes.
And Daniel, we heard from a number of listeners who said that they've seen a decline in the bee population in their backyards and where they live. What has your experience been like?
Well, I know that the colony collapse disorder actually exists, but I've actually seen the opposite. For the past 20 years I've been doing this, it's actually been very positive, because I find that as the ecosystems that we create in gardens and the urban environment get more complex over the years, we see more and more species showing up, and it's pretty amazing. I love watching the plants and seeing all the new bees that I don't even know the names of show up. And I applaud Ellen for her answer, because when we talk about this issue, I get a little frustrated, because we talk about bees in general. We depend on the domestic bee for our pollination, but that's, we've set it up that way. And that's another issue around monoculture, is if, you know, they say almond orchards, for example, depend on the bees. Well, that's because when the almonds aren't flowering, there's nothing else there. And so it would require simply managing these orchards in different ways in order to have the native pollinators there.
And what explains all of these new species you're seeing?
Creating the habitat for them. Colony collapse disorder doesn't exist for most native bees because they don't have colonies. Most of them are solitary bees, and they mate and they feed and they die. There's a few exceptions like the bumblebee, but the main loss of them is loss of habitat, and we can easily, and it's actually really fun and positive, to create habitat for them, and they come. You know, it's amazing that if you put it there, they will come. yeah.
Well, and also, Ellen, you have said that the native bees depend on native vegetation, and another problem is that so much native vegetation has been removed. Can you talk about that?
Well, Yeah, well, there are so many more people now than there were in California, say, 100 years ago. And as our populations increase, we build more roads, we build more shopping malls, we build more homes, and we take what used to be native plants and we convert them to our gardens, as Daniel mentioned. And people brought their ideas with them of what a garden should be like, and they brought plants that they remembered maybe from being children back east, or if you came, say, from Asia, you might want to have the plants that you remembered as a child. But really the best thing to do would be for us to change the way when we're in our homes and gardens and public parks and golf courses to go back to using more native plants, and then to select plants that we know do have more value for the bees, instead of just selecting plants because of the way they look or because we, you know, we have some attachment to them, like we want to use them in a flower arrangement or something. So there are there's a big difference in flowers, whether they're attractive to bees or not. And many cultivated garden plants, they have double petals. And so like roses that are real big, fluffy roses, they don't have any pollen anymore because that part of the flower has been replaced with petals. So there's a new effort now to educate people about how to select better bee plants.
Daniel, did you want to jump in there?
Yeah, we're actually really lucky in Berkeley. We have Professor Gordon Franke and his team who've actually spent more than 10 years assigning his graduate students to just sitting down in front of urban gardens and counting the bees that show up on each plant. So I would encourage people to go to nature.berkeley.edu/urban-bee-gardens. And they've done a lot of work on just counting which plants are attractive and valuable to honeybees and native bees. And they break down, you don't have to just plant native plants. Of course, native bees have co-evolved with native plants, and a lot of them are specialists on them. But you can plant plants in the categories of food, herbs, both culinary and medicinal, native flowers and non-native flowers, and weeds. A lot of them will support pollinators.
And can you give us an example of a group or maybe a community garden that decided to bring back more native plants? And then what happened? What is the time frame we're talking about where they start to see new species?
You can see it right away. It's because the native pollinators actually still exist in our urban environments. It's pretty amazing. There's 4,000 kinds in the U.S., 1,500 species in California. They've counted 250 species in 7 cities around here, and there's 85 to 90 that still reside in Berkeley. So if you give them habitat, they will come use it. I don't know so many community gardens have actually chosen specifically to bring in bees, but just by the act of doing it, it happens. And there's data that shows that community gardens and just gardens in general that have a diversity of 10 or more species of plants with large patches of each of them, you know, flowering plants that the bees can use, bring in increased populations of pollinators, both domestic and native.
And Ellen, I think because of the decline of the bee colonies, a lot of people are, I mean, we know this really, but we don't think about it much, that these pollinators are just so crucial for so many reasons. And can you just talk a little bit about why this issue is so important, why ensuring biodiversity at the local level is so important?
Well, diversity creates stability. And so in terms of environmental change, like global warming, the more diversity we have in terms of plants and animals, the greater the stability of that system is of the whole system to collapse in the face of some like really dramatic change. So it just makes everything more stable. It's better for the future. It's better for all the future generations. If things get too out of whack, you know, and say we lose a lot of the native bees, the native vegetation and our California native plants, they depend on those insects as well as us. I mean, so we're not in it all alone. It's about we have to learn to live with nature and support nature, because nature is supporting us as humans, you know, to survive on Earth. So, I mean, that's kind of dramatic, but that really is the end point that is what was worrying people specifically in the face of climate change.
Absolutely.
Daniel, what would you add to that?
Well, if she was talking about diversity of ecosystems, over time, if we add complexity to our gardens, it helps build those ecosystems within them. And there's a lot of factors that that describe gardens that support this kind of habitat, and that those are diversity, gardens that are less manicured, gardens that don't use pesticides and herbicides, and gardens that have successive blooming that provide food to these pollinators over time. You know, an example of complexity is that it's not just adding these plants, like adding ingredients to a recipe. It's letting the ecosystem evolve in place. Like a lot of native bees, they 70% of them, they reside in the ground and they nest in the ground. And 30% of them do that in logs and dead vegetation. So you have to leave a certain amount of stuff in your garden and let that complexity build. In Spiral Gardens, since we're volunteer run, there's a lot of areas that get very green and furry and are not very manicured. But those are the places where I really find those special creatures. You know, that's where I find the millipedes and the centipedes, and I see the bees, and things have actually been left alone long enough that they can reproduce. And sometimes native bee populations, they take a year to reproduce, and they spend a few weeks out there foraging and reproducing, but the rest of that year they're taking shelter in your soil, and leaving areas undisturbed and letting them grow the way nature intended them to, is a lot of what allows this complexity, this diversity, to evolve.
That is Daniel Miller. He's director of the Spiral Gardens Community Food Security Project in Berkeley. Ellen Zagari is director of horticulture at the UC Davis Arboretum. And today we are talking about what we can do to ensure biodiversity at the local level. Last month, we did a show about the rapid decline of the bee population, and so many of you called concerned about the issue and also just talking about what you're seeing in your own garden and your community. So what are you seeing now? Have things changed for you? Have you taken any steps to bring back native plants? What can we do to create more pollinator-friendly spaces? We'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website. And if you have any questions for Ellen and Daniel about what you can do personally to bring back these creatures in your garden, we'd love to hear from you. And Ellen, at UC Davis, there's been a landscape conversion. Can you talk about that? What changes have you all made, and what changes have you seen as a result?
Well, there are actually is more than one landscape conversion going on right now, but the one that's had the most media coverage and is especially important for bees is called the Honeybee Haven. And that garden used a lot of our what we call Arboretum All-Star plants, which is 100 selected plants that were picked for variety to bloom year-round, but also because many of them are good plants for pollen and nectar and will bring in native species. And at the Honeybee Haven, professor there, Robin Thorpe, has been identifying the bees as they've been coming back since the garden's been built, and I think he's up in like the 80s now of different kinds of native species, because while we're not in an urban area, our landscapes are highly modified the same way that urban areas are because of the agriculture. It's equally, it changes the landscape completely and makes it into a monoculture, and will not necessarily support bees. So we've been really happy to see that happen. Also at our events, we do outreach for people, and I have created small demonstration gardens where people can come, see the flowers, see the bees, and I have volunteers there who will talk about building bee condos, as they call them, creating artificial structures that will help the bees find places to nest in your yard, and also, as Daniel mentioned, leaving areas alone for the ground bees, the ones that nest in the ground. So we have, and then we're also doing other conversions in what we're calling these naturalized landscapes, so removing lawns, putting back native grasses, and then hopefully eventually we'll be putting back the native wildflowers as well.
And we have an email from Jackie who says, another factor, many newer hybrid plants have no fragrance, hence no bees. An example, red passion vine has no fragrance, while the old blue-white passion vine has a lovely fragrance, and mine supports lots of bees, year-round fritillary butterflies, and even small wasps that feed on them. Daniel, can you talk a little bit about fragrance and how that affects pollinators.
Well, I don't know so much about fragrance. I know that the old-fashioned varieties of flowers, if you're going to plant non-native flowers, the old-fashioned varieties are more likely to provide pollen and nectar that the plants need. And a lot of the newer hybrids were developed for looks, aesthetics, versus, you know, being closer to their roots as plants. So, you know, if you make a garden that looks more like your grandma's garden, rather than the new thing, you're much more likely to have flowers that actually support pollinators.
Wow, you just brought back a great visual. I used to eat the smallest, most delicious strawberries in my grandma's garden. When you say new thing, what is that? I mean, how have gardens changed over the decades?
Well, they hybridized, like I said, they hybridized flowers for looks. You know, they're always, you know, trying to get the new thing on the market that's going to become, you know, that's going to go viral and become the plant that everybody wants. And that's about marketing, you know. And so it's about us going beyond marketing and looking at plants for their intrinsic value rather than, you know, the new thing your neighbors have. And, you know, that's it's fun and it's easy and it's just a much stronger base to work from.
Ellen, do you have anything else to add about fragrance?
Well, I'm kind of with Daniel in that I'm sitting here pondering what is the connection between nectar glands and the thing in the flower that produces fragrance. But he's absolutely correct in that in breeding, horticulturists have they're always looking for the next new thing and something they like. Like, people actually like flowers that are a little strange looking sometimes. And so they're doing this breeding and selection for unusual forms. And in the process of doing that, they do eliminate the structures that will support the insects, sort of by accident. You know, I don't think it's on purpose or anything. But so I know that fragrance is the way that moths find flowers, because moths fly generally at night, and they're more attracted to white flowers, which are more easily seen in the dark. So there's definitely a connection there between that pollinator, a moth-type evening kind of pollinator, and the presence of fragrance. So in that way, when you have fragrant flowers, you're going to increase that part of the diversity.
All right. Well, thank you. Interesting question, Jackie, and comment. Thanks for your comment. Let's go to a caller. Let's hear from Karen in San Francisco. Hi, Karen. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I wanted to let people know, especially for those who live in San Francisco, there is a new urban agriculture garden project that's focused on bees and bee pollinators and other pollinators, and it's called The Bee Farm, and it's operated by nonprofit San Francisco Bee Cause, that's BEE-CAUSE, and we have nearly a half an acre lot on San Bruno Avenue in San Francisco that borders Highway 101, where there's a large unmanaged area that we hope currently does support native bees. And we're developing this former weed and garbage lot into a bee farm, a farm that we have an apiary of honeybees, and we sell the honey to support our project. And we're trying to plant all sorts of different flowers and vegetables that we hope will support particularly the native bees in the area. I mean, one of the problems, I think, like Daniel said, you know, you plant it and they will come, but sometimes certain bee species are just gone. The smaller bees fly smaller distances, and so you could plant a lot of great plants that you might read attract bees in certain areas, and you won't find bees coming anymore. So one of the things that we're going to be trying to do is to identify what are the plants that grow well in San Francisco that can support our remaining local native bees as well as honeybees.
And so when you started this project, I mean, what were some of the most important steps to take to ensure that the bees actually thrive?
Well, we're actually in our first year. We just passed our first year anniversary of having this lot. And as anybody knows who's tried to take a weed and garbage lot and turn it into a garden, moving at nature's pace is not as quick as we would like. So we're still just kind of starting up. We didn't get water access until January. So what we're trying to do is plant as many diverse plants that will flower, including fruit trees. Herbs, of course, are very favored by bees. Wildflowers, native plants, pretty much anything and everything that we can find in the literature, like Gordon Franke's website, Urban Bee Gardens. We have lots of great resources in the Bay Area. The Pollinator Partnership, a national organization, is based in San Francisco. They've got great resources online. We've got the Xerces Society, based out of Portland, that also publishes lots of lists of plants that are beneficial to bees and actually other pollinators that you can try in your area. So what we're going to be doing is, I think as the other two, the two people on the line here have said, is plant as many diverse plants as we can, leave certain areas unmanaged for nesting habitat, and we're just going to have to learn by doing it.
Well, thank you so much for calling in, Karen. And we've got another question from a caller. If flowers are not native but are drought-resistant, are they good to plant, like some African varieties? Daniel, do you know?
Well, drought resistance is definitely something to look at for plants. It's less about that, though, and more about what plants have actually shown value for bees. And you can either look at research like Gordon Franke's website, or you can do your own. You know, it's really a fun thing to do, to put in a plant and then watch what happens. And, you know, as you do that, you'll learn more about not just the plants that work, but also who your native pollinators are. I'm slowly learning about the different kinds of bumblebees and orchard mason bees and carpenter bees and longhorn bees, sweat bees, digger bees, leaf-cutting bees, yellow-faced bees, wool carders. And they may or may not want to use that drought-tolerant plant from Africa, but plants don't necessarily have to be native, but the bees will, you know, the test is in whether the bees use them or not.
And what would you add to that, Ellen?
Well, I actually talked to Gordon Franke about this one time because I was curious. And of the plants that they have monitored both in Berkeley and up at the city cemetery in Sacramento, he has a research project going up there as well. The only one from South Africa is one called a bulbini. It's B-U-L-B-I-N-E. That's the only South African cultivated garden plant he's found that any of the bees use. They don't use the other ones. And so that probably just has to do with the differences in evolution and the relationships between insects and plants in those areas. That's just different enough that plants from South Africa, which are the ones we mainly would try to grow here as drought tolerant, they don't support the bees. Whereas things from the Mediterranean, like herbs, like cat mint and oregano, the honeybees they have evolved with those plants, and so they do heavily use those plants. We have lavender plants that you can hear them before you see them. They have so many European honeybees on them because they evolved together and they can utilize the resources there very easily.
That is Ellen Zagary, Director of Horticulture at the UC Davis Arboretum. And we'll talk more about the Arboretum and their educational programs after the break. Daniel Miller is Director of the Spiral Gardens Community Food Security Project in Berkeley. Today we're talking about what we can do to ensure biodiversity at the local level. And I just found this great website about bee facts. And honeybees are responsible for pollinating approximately 80% of all fruit, vegetables, and crops in the U.S. Bees communicate with each other by dancing. Brains of bees are the size of a sesame seed, which are about 20,000 times smaller than the human brain. And honeybees have 5 eyes, 3 small ones on top of the head, and 2 big ones in front. Few bee facts for you. We're talking about biodiversity. It's your call. We'll be back after this.
This is your call on Local Public Radio. If you'd like to join today's conversation, add a perspective that you haven't heard yet today, or if you have a question you feel needs to be answered, please get in touch with us by calling 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org or post a comment or question at yourcallradio.org.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we'll have a conversation about how immigration reform will affect California's economy. There is a bill in the Senate that could result in a huge influx of highly skilled foreign-born workers. So what does an increase of immigrant tech workers mean for those already here? And how will immigration reform affect the unemployment rate in California, the economy, and people living in this state? That's tomorrow. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. If you'd like to join today's show about what it will take to ensure biodiversity at the local level, we'd love to hear from you. What changes have you seen in your garden and your community gardens? What changes would you like to see? Do you have questions about what it will take to bring back the birds and the bees? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Or leave a comment on our website. How are you creating a diverse habitat by planting a wide variety of fruits, vegetables, and flowers? And today we're joined by Ellen Zagary, Director of Horticulture at the UC Davis Arboretum. She focuses on how our constructed landscapes can help support the biodiversity of native insects and other wildlife. Daniel Miller is the Director of Spiral Gardens Community Food Security Project in Berkeley. Their mission is to create healthy, sustainable communities by promoting a strong local food system and encouraging productive use of urban soil. And let's hear from Steve in San Francisco. Hi, Steve. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you, Rose. I thought that maybe your listening audience would be interested in the San Francisco Succulent and Cactus Society are having their 26th annual show and sale at the San Francisco County Fair Building this weekend from 9 to 5. And for those that want to reduce their lawns and cut back on pesticides and so forth and conserve water, succulents and cactuses might be an avenue of expression for their outdoor biodiversity.
All right, that's a great tip. Thank you so much for that information. And we'll put a link on our site right after the show. Thank you, Steve. Let's hear next from Mark in San Francisco. Hi, Mark.
Hi. My question is, does anybody there know if City College keeps bees? I live near City College. I have a ton of bees in my garden, which I love. I also installed a fountain about 6 months ago, and they just swarm in to drink water. Is that common?
Wow. So did you ask about City College? Your line was cutting out.
City College, and I have a lot of honeybees, and I don't know if they keep honeybees, but they're coming from somewhere in this part of the city.
Interesting. Thank you. Daniel, do you have any idea if City College has bees?
I don't know about City College and their bee population, but I do know that providing a source of water in your garden is one of the really important things you should do, whether it's a bird bath or a fountain. That is something that you can really do to help support native wildlife and give them a clean source of water to drink from. Everything from bees, butterflies, hummingbirds, birds, small mammals, they need that water.
Do they sometimes have a hard time finding it?
Yes, they do. Adding a water feature or I saw something as simple yesterday as taking a hollow log and putting a flat piece of copper in it just to make a little shallow bowl. That could make your yard, a special yard for a lot of these creatures.
Why do they have a hard time finding clean water?
Well, it's not always provided. I mean, if you look around most of our yards, not everybody has that in their yard. And it's kind of an old-fashioned thing to have a bird bath, but it serves more than just birds bathing.
Wow. So, I mean, you could even, I'm just picturing one of those big silver bowls. You could just really fill that with water and just stick it on top of something.
Anything.
Would that work?
Yeah, anything. As long as there's purchase for the insects and other creatures to sit on the side of it and not fall in. You don't want it to provide a drowning trap. You want something shallow, something with texture, something with, a couple rocks in it so that they can go in and out. A lot of times the bees will sit on a rock that is next to the water and lap up the water that just comes by capillary action up the side of the rock.
Wow. All right. So don't drown them, but put rocks in the bowl so they have something to stand on.
Exactly.
Okay. Thank you so much, Mark. It sounds like you're really enjoying all of your honeybees, your new visitors. Let's go next to Kimo in Brisbane. Hi, Kimo. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I'm going to be moving into a new house soon, and I'm going to be doing exactly what you're asking, or to the best of my ability. But the one thing is that is not welcome in my backyard are yellow jackets. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, it's war with yellow jackets. I'm highly allergic to them. They're very aggressive. I'm sure that there's a good reason for them being in nature, but I don't want them in my backyard. So how do I attract all the other bees and keep these things out?
All right, Ellen, can you give us some? Can you give them some tips?
Well, there is a website here at Davis. It's the IPM, Integrated Pest Management. It's ipm.ucdavis.edu. And if you go there and you do a search on yellow jackets, they will give you recommendations for ways to manage the yellow jackets. The problem that we have with yellow jackets is they're actually carnivores, and they're looking for meat. They're looking for things to eat, and that's why when we make our barbecue and we do our hamburgers and hot dogs, they always show up. You know, they're looking for something to eat. What you need to do is look for the nest and focus on trying to eliminate the nests. And even the most, liberal of the people here on campus that are entomologists and want to protect all pollinators, they've said, no, it's perfectly okay to try to eliminate a yellow jacket nest because they are so aggressive. And it's not like we're going to be able to make them go extinct. It's just not going to happen. So they just need to be managed as part of the wildlife that can be dangerous to particularly people that are allergic and then young children and elderly.
All right. Well, thank you for calling, Kimo, and good luck with your new garden. And Ellen, I'm wondering, at the Arboretum at UC Davis, are you receiving more inquiries from the public about these issues?
Yeah, I regularly
the decline of the bee colony?
Speak to the Master Gardener groups. The Master Gardeners are in all 44 counties in the state of California, and they want to become good gardeners, and they work. They're a UC affiliate. They do outreach and education, distributing the University of California information that's developed. And they've really been in high demand for two reasons. One, people are concerned about reducing their water use because of increasing costs, but also the reason for converting more of your garden to natives and to areas that support wildlife. And I do that pretty regularly, and I have some prepared talks and resource lists and things like that. People are becoming more aware of this now, and they really want to do the right thing, which is great. And so they need the information.
That's Ellen Zagary, Director of Horticulture at the UC Davis Arboretum. Daniel Miller is the Director of the Spiral Gardens Community Food Security Project in Berkeley. And today we're talking about what we can do to ensure biodiversity at the local level. What can we do to bring back bees and ensure that butterflies and the birds and the bees are all healthy and thriving? We have another question over email from Karen, who says, I graduated in 2002 from UC Berkeley's Landscape Architecture BA program. At the time, the design program was entirely focused on aesthetics and looked down on designing with edibles or native plants. What can be done to alter new landscape architects, ad designers, to think more responsibly about creating biodiversity in our urban environments? That's an interesting one, Ellen. Have you come across that before?
Oh, absolutely. And it's something that we, it's not easy to change people's minds when, if we have cultural values that are embedded. And I think that with designers, particularly, their primary focus is on design and what it looks like and the artistic side of it. But more and more of them are becoming aware of the impacts that that has. And there is a movement for sustainable gardening and LEED credits, like with buildings and green building. There's a strong movement now toward green landscapes, and which sounds redundant, but it's actually true that you incorporate the principles of sustainability and conservation of resources and what they call ecosystem services support, which is clean water, supporting wildlife, and contributing to the stability of the environment in general.
And Daniel, do you encounter this? And how do you deal with it?
Absolutely. And shows like this, education, are really vital in changing this. Because we need to reshape some of our societal values. A lot of this is a response to concern about property values and aesthetics, you know, that are mandated by homeowners associations. Or, you know, the lawn was originally a sign of wealth. The people who had lawns way back when, centuries ago, were the people who didn't have to grow their own food. And it showed that you were status. And then the middle class then wanted to emulate that. And then, you know, the poorest people wanted to emulate that because it showed you had money. And we need to and you didn't have to use your land to sustain yourself. And we need to, this is a point where we need to redefine those values. And it's all about education. And, you know, the architecture schools will respond to what the public wants. And so we as the public need to voice these values and so that it then becomes part of our institutions.
What are you doing to promote this kind of gardening and diversity? And what sort of reaction do you receive from, you know, like cities, for example, or organizations that really have the power to affect massive change when we talk about biodiversity?
Are you asking me?
Yes, Daniel.
First, what I've done is I've devoted my life to it. So I've been doing this work for about 25 years. And the response is generally very positive. People are looking so hard for something good right now because we get so much bad news. And it's great to be in my job and the people working with me where we can actually do that. You know, you hear this show about how bees are dying, and I can come on and say, well, actually, I've seen bees increase in the yards that I'm working in because we've given to them, we've provided this habitat for them. So the solutions are generally things that people really will latch onto if they're given. You know, sometimes it requires a transition. We're not used to it. It takes work and attention and education. And those are, you know, the folks like, you know, the folks on the show and the people who called in can do over time, you know, and people need a way to deal with proactively with their concerns. It's much better than sitting with the doom and gloom of like, oh my God, everything's going to collapse. There's very easy things that we can do in our own yard that add to our own health, our own enjoyment, and, you know, provide better communities. And I found that people really know this, you know, and you can talk on a number of different levels, not just pollination, about what doing this kind of work in your community does, but it's infectious.
It's a nice way to put it. Yeah. Oh, we've got about 10 minutes left, and if you'd like to join us, if you have questions or comments about biodiversity and your garden, community gardens, what we can all do to ensure a healthy population of birds and bees, you can give us a call, 866-798-8255. And you can email feedback@yourcallradio.org. This is why I love our listeners. Armand in San Francisco just wrote in about the water. We mentioned that it's hard sometimes for birds and bees and wildlife to find clean water. And we were talking about putting even a metal bowl in your backyard with some rocks to ensure they don't slip and drown, so they have something to stand on. And he just wrote, the big metal bowls are available in a big store on Clement Street around 6th or 7th Avenue in San Francisco, and all kinds of sizes for a pretty reasonable price. So thank you for that. And Karen writes in, for those of you interested in helping out or learning more about the bee farm on San Bruno Avenue in San Francisco, the cross street is Ordway. We have volunteer work parties twice a month, the second Sunday and fourth Saturday. On June 22nd, the work party will include special events in celebration of, National Pollinator Week, June 17th through the 23rd. You can learn more at their Facebook page. It's San Francisco Bee Cause, B-E-E-C-A-U-S-E. Thank you so much, Karen. And we will put a link on the website right after the show. And let's go back to the phones. Let's hear from Ira in San Francisco. Hi, Ira.
Hi. I'm a landscape architect and a gardener, and I include native plants in most of my designs to try to ensure, you know, food for pollinators. And in my own garden here in the Castro, it's very diverse, full of lots of different plants, water, no pesticides. And this year I've seen, you know, very few honeybees. So it's just been, it's a comment, it's just been very disturbing.
Yeah, well, and we got a few calls like that last time. And stay on the line because I wanted to ask you about architecture programs. Daniel, what advice would you give to Ira and others who've seen a decline in honeybees in their backyards?
Maybe start some beehives. you know, domestic bees, there are wild swarms out there, but they're also dependent on people keeping bees around you. So the solution to people losing 50% of their hives is, you know, 100% more people becoming beekeepers. And then joining associations where the you share information on how to prevent some of the things that are killing the bees, like a simple solution I've learned is, if you're keeping bees, using thyme oil to help with the mite problem that was killing so many bees. And, you know, not everybody wants to become a beekeeper, but also folks just following a lot of the practices that we've been talking today will help tremendously. Not using toxins in your yard, providing more and more plants to provide habitat, restoring habitat, you know, not giving up, just doing it more. Would really help. And, you know, less people going to buy Roundup or using, you know, malathion for their aphid problems. Or, you know, it just, it can be reversed. It just, it takes persistence and you know, following all these practices that we're talking about.
And Ellen, do you have any more tips?
Well, one thing is the reason they may not be seeing bees is they're not, that you're just not close enough to an open area where there are plants and flowers, and it's particularly in cities like San Francisco, it's so developed that you might just be a little too far from the distances that the insects are normally going to be able to fly to find resources. And so if we can create, or if it could become a value to create more pocket gardens, I know they're doing that in the East Bay, where you convert areas within the urban landscape and take them and turn them back into garden areas and take out, like, some parking spots. And I know restaurants, and they do that sort of thing, where they'll take over some parking and then pay, excuse me, rent to the city for the use of that. And then if they surround that area with gardens, then you're going to create little stepping stones where the pollinators can move across the urban landscape and find the resources that they're seeking.
Yeah, we're seeing a lot more of that in San Francisco. And Ian, are you still with us?
Yes,
oh,
I am.
Did we lose Ian? Oh, okay. I just wanted to ask you quickly about Karen's email. She's the one who graduated from UC Berkeley's Landscape Architecture BA program. What are your thoughts about these design programs focusing on aesthetics and looking down on designing with edibles or native plants, for example? How can that be changed?
I graduated from the same program 18 years ago, the graduate program, and the emphasis was on aesthetics, but I came into the program with an interest in horticulture, so I was able to stay focused and to always, you know, keep that in mind as I was interpreting, you know, what they were saying. So, you know, architecture and design has a long history, and it will take time, I think, for people to incorporate some of these broader principles. But to leave, I just want to leave one comment, which is, I haven't seen a lot of honeybees, but I have seen several different species of native bees and bumblebees in my garden.
Great. Well, thank you so much, and hopefully the honeybees will eventually return. And before we get back to calls, I just want to ask you, Ellen, about pesticides, because Daniel just brought up Roundup. On our last show, our guests named a number of pesticides that people are using, and they might not know the extent of the damage that the pesticides are causing. Can you give us some names of pesticides that are widely used that might be hurting ecosystems?
Well, up here, there's been research done on lawn care products. Apparently, there's to treat your lawn, the herbicides that they use to kill the broadleaf weeds in turf areas, it gets into the water supply, and it's very persistent. So the first thing I would say is you want to never use any pesticide that has any persistent nature, you know, and that's the older the older things, many of which have been pulled from the shelves and that homeowners are no longer able to purchase. I believe that's true of Malathion, but I don't really know, so I'd have to check that. But what the Integrated Pest Management Program recommends is that if you feel you must use, like the aphids are just ruining, you know, you're not going to get any cabbages this year, that you use soaps and you use least toxic pesticides is what they call them, things that break down very easily, have immediate action, but then are gone from the environment. So an insect that can fly, when they see you coming with your soap sprayer, they can just get out of the way. And then the poison doesn't last. It dissipates immediately, and then they can come back. One thing that's been proven to be now, just recently, super bad for bees is imidaproclid. It has a bunch of other names, commercial names, and things that are these nicotinoids. It's like a nicotine, artificial nicotine, and they use them on trees, and they put them on the roots, and then the trees absorb it up into the trunk. So it's great for... we have aphids on our hackberries here, and they get some. Your car gets so sticky underneath it, you can't open the door sometimes. So they found that pesticide is very persistent in the plant over long periods of time. And so those are the ones that are they're recommending now as a movement that those be pulled. And
right.
Because of the damage they find on not only the honeybees, but also it apparently has changed the behavior of the bees, so the bees get weakened, and then they can't find their resources. But there's still a lot of debate, scientific debate, about that. But if you go to the Xerxes Society website, they can give you more information on the current research.
Okay, and we spoke in extensively about nicotinoids on the last show, and these are the pesticides that were banned in the European Union. And Daniel, do you have any other resources where people can find a very straightforward list of the pesticides, the everyday pesticides that so many people use that might be harming birds and honeybee, bees, for example?
I am not an expert in the ones that are harming the birds and the pollinators and everything because I don't use them. I just treat them as an anathema, a death in a bottle. And there are none that I think people should use. Basically, you know, don't go to Home Depot for your pest control because there's going to be very little there that is actually reasonable to use. Ellen was right. You know, some of the simplest things to use are... You know, you can even go below soap and use a hard stream of water to knock the aphids off your plants. A lot of times the aphids won't make it back onto the plants. Soap is next. I use a natural product called neem, which is the oil from the seed of a tree in India that is very good against insects, but they also put it in toothpaste. but you have to be careful. Like even something like neem, you don't want to spray near an area where bees are. I use it on leafy vegetables that are not in flower, where bees are not coming. And every time you use even an organic pesticide, you are killing things and you're eliminating some of the ecology. So that's a choice you have to carefully make. A lot of times, just allowing some of your pests to be around, it's part of this developing this complex ecology that we're talking about. When you start from nothing, the first thing you're going to get are pests. The predators of those pests come later. So you have to allow some of the pests to exist for their natural predators to be around.
And where can listeners go to find more information about alternatives to pesticides?
There's lots of those out there. I mean, the old classic were the Rodale books that list a lot of these things. You know, I like, for locally, my reference for a lot of things is the Golden Gate Gardener, written by Pam Pierce, who was on this show with me last time I was here. If you just Google non-toxic pest control, you'll find umpteen different books out there. The information exists. You know, it's, you know, I can't tell you the go-to be-all, but, you know, it's not hard to find. And those, what I just said, are some of the basic solutions right there.
Okay. Well, we've got time for one more call. Let's hear from Holly in Santa Cruz. Hi, Holly. Welcome to the show.
Hi, everybody. This is for all the beekeepers. I really feel that we should keep our hands off of the honeybees completely. And that would be just give them a home if you're so inclined, then just leave them alone. And do not take their honey. The honey belongs to them. And that's how I wanted to say right now. I'm a little shy. I've never been on the air before. So let's just give honeybees a chance and just thank you.
Okay.
Thank you,
all right. Well, thank you so much, Holly. Thanks for calling in. Do we have time for one more call? Hi, you're on the air? George. Hi, George. George, are you with us? Nope, I think we lost George. All right, so why don't you both give us final thoughts? Ellen, what are your final thoughts on ensuring biodiversity? It seems like awareness is out there. People are really interested in this issue. And in fact, I have to apologize because we have so many listeners on the line and we didn't have time to take them all.
Yeah, I think that one of the things we're working toward is providing easily accessible resources for people to, people can't, you know, a lot of people don't know how to garden. They never have really done it. It's particularly in urban areas. And so we try to provide resources for people that are getting started to get them started successfully. And then once you get the bug, so to speak, or you get absorbed in gardening and you work like Daniel has most of his life, it sounds like, on this gardening ideal. And we want to make it simple for beginners, but also be able to carry on conversations with more sophisticated people to help them take it to the next level. And one of the things I would like to see is highways and golf courses, those big public areas that are already open and they're not going to get built on, seeing some of those areas convert to more naturalized landscapes that have more of these plants in them, because I think that's how we'll have the biggest impact.
All right, and Daniel, quick final thoughts, 20 seconds.
Yeah, for every show programs like this that talk about a problem, let's have a show that is solutionary, that talks about things that people can do hands-on. And I tell everybody, just try it. Go to the Urban Bee Gardens website and maybe go to Larner Seeds and pick 10 seeds to plant.
All right. Well, we also provided a lot of solutions this hour. And Laura just wrote in, check out Northwest Center for Alternatives to Pesticides. Thank you, Laura. Daniel Miller is director of the Spiral Gardens Community Food Security Project in Berkeley. Ellen Zagary is director of horticulture at the UC Davis Arboretum. Thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
And thanks for your... Thank you for your phone calls and emails. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. How will immigration reform affect California's economy? On the next Your Call, we'll discuss the impact of immigration on the tech sector. A Senate bill could result in a huge influx of highly skilled foreign-born workers. So what does that mean for tech workers who are already here? Join us at 10 or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Why are tech companies lobbying for more immigrant workers? What will this mean for the state's unemployment rate and the economy? It's Your Call.
Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Raz is on and Ali Budner produced the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer and Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.
Hello, this is Chuck Finney of Your Legal Rights. If you're planning to get married and want to protect your separate property, please join me this Wednesday evening at 7 when we'll talk about prenuptial agreements. My guests will be certified specialists in family law Jeremy Klein and Yasmin Mehmet. And if you have other family law questions, please plan to call in. That's this Wednesday evening at 7 on 91.7 KLW San Francisco.
I'm Don Lowry from the Temescal District in North Oakland, and I'm proud to be a monthly contributor to KALW Public Radio because of the wonderful variety of its programs.
Hello, I'm Chloe Tilly. Welcome to World Have Your Say, and you're discussing the demonstrations in Turkey.
The main opposition party played an active role in these protests. They have always supported the extremists. People can demonstrate legally. There are places for such demonstrations in Istanbul.
It began as a protest over building on green space. 4 days later, hundreds of thousands of people have been on the streets in 67 towns and cities across Turkey. Protesters say their secular country is moving towards more Islamic values. The Prime Minister is trying to increase his power and excessive police force. Well, with an effective media blackout, protesters have taken to social media, something Prime Minister Erdogan called a menace, saying the best example of lies can be found there. We'll be live speaking to demonstrators and Erdogan supporters as we take you to the heart of the story.